there's the problems with the contracting of these wars, of the private contractors that come in and make huge killings off of the military, servicing the military, off of the presence of the military in these countries, that they, in essence, fuel political support for the war. And we've just got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, certainly there's that aspect. And I think in a comprehensive look at the war, that's got to be one of the things we look at. You know, why are these contractors there? Did we form our military incorrectly that we have to buy all these contracts to do the job?
We want to thank you very much. General Daniel Bolger has been our guest, Lieutenant General, who has written the book, Why We Lost, A General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. He served 35 years in the U.S. Army before retiring last year. I'll be speaking at Maplewood High School tomorrow night, Thursday night at 7:30. Check our website. And on Saturday, I'll be in Berlin, Germany, at Compaq's 10th anniversary. Go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Martin Newman, Shakespeare, Martinez, and Alpapani Masood, Rabbi Karandina Gezder. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland. Today's guest is Indigenous Movement activist and scholar Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who has just released a new, powerful new book entitled An Indigenous People's History of the United States.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBOO Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling in the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling. Voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. your community radio station. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and my name's Paul Rowland. We have a very special guest this morning from San Francisco, California, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Good morning, Roxanne.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, I just couldn't help myself to start out with that song, and obviously you know why I did, and we'll talk about that right off the bat. But before we do, I just want to read. I'm never very comfortable with these introductions, so I'm just going to read what's on your book flap from your book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, if that's okay with you.
Okay.
So you grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. You've been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and are known for your lifelong commitment to national and international social justice issues. After receiving your PhD in history at the University of California at Los Angeles, you taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at California State University Hayward and helped found the departments of Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies. Your 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. You're also the author or editor of seven other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico. And as I said, you live in San Francisco. And yeah, this book, as I mentioned on our website in the introduction to this program, and has been said by numerous people in some of the advanced praise for the book, that it reframes American history, obviously, as the title suggests, from an indigenous perspective. And in your first, your introduction, you actually talk about that song I just played. So maybe we could start out by talking about that.
Yeah, about this land, huh? you know, it was the original title for the book itself. We ended up not having a double title, but it's long struck me. The first time I remember thinking about it was actually in 1967. I knew the song, of course, everyone. This land, and I'm from Oklahoma, not far from where Woody Guthrie also grew up. And I love Woody Guthrie, you know, and that song just bothered me. And I was driving across country, and I was in the, you know, in the territory of the Navajo Nation, and it just hit me. That song came into my head, and I said, no, that's not right. There's something wrong with that song. And that's why it's so popular. It's a settler song, you know, that this is, it sounds good because it's talking about, you know, private property and corporations and agribusiness and people who are landless, which of course my father was a landless, you know, was a sharecropper, landless farmer. So it was, you know, dear to my heart in some ways in my politics. But then, you know, there's that sense of, well, this is disputed, you know, whose land is this? So I was pretty young then and not yet involved in the American Indian movement. So it took a while for it to kind of gel and for me to really begin thinking about settler colonialism, a term that really was not in the lexicon of either academia or popular culture in the United States until very recently.
Well, you know, of course, up here in this area, there's another very famous song by Woody Guthrie called Roll on Columbia. And ever since I moved here, and actually basically when I first moved here, I got involved in Native American fishing rights, which is a long, long history, rich history in this around here, both in the Puget Sound and on the what the indigenous people call the Nchiwana, and was called the Columbia, and which is a very, very interesting, obviously, harking back to the supposed discoverer of the Americas, Christopher Columbus. And that always stuck in my craw. And then there's actually been some, you know, alternative versions of that I like a lot better. But yeah, so I mean, Woody Guthrie was hired by the Bonneville Power Administration to basically glorify,
you know, what better symbol of the settler colonialism than the dams on the Columbia River?
Right. And did you know about the four verses that got dropped later that actually refer very racist terms to Native Americans?
No.
Oh, well, let me read them to you.
Okay.
I have them right here. Someone sent them to me recently. here are four verses. It's there on the banks that we fought many a fight, Sheridan's boys in the blockhouse at night. They saw us in death, but never in light. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Our loved ones we lost in Coe's little store by fireball and rifle, a dozen or more. We won by the Mary and soldiers she bore. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Remember the trial when the battle was won, the wild Indian warriors to the tall timber run. We hung ever Indian with smoke at his gun. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Year after year, we had tedious trial, fighting the rapids at Cascades and Dalles. Injuns, rest peaceful on Menaloose Isle. Roll on, Columbia, roll on.
Oh, my.
So those were original stanzas.
That was an amazing coincidence that I just mentioned that.
Yeah. I'll send it to you. I just received it a couple of days ago from someone, and I was really shocked.
Well, you know, I kind of wanted to get here maybe a little later in the conversation, but maybe we should, you know, since we're sort of heading that way right now. I mean, you know, Woody Guthrie, you know, I mean, yeah, you said you loved him. I obviously, you know, he was an incredible, you know, figure in American culture. He was a very courageous man, a very creative man, had a lot of very wonderful qualities. And at the same time, he embodied this, the underbelly of the settler colonial culture, all the contradictions that you know, that certainly are in me, or I guess in all of us, in a sense, to the extent that we haven't really tried to address them. So, yeah, I guess it comes as no surprise, really.
Yeah, Okema, Oklahoma is the heart of Muscogee Creek land, so that land was taken by allotment, you know, by the federal government and parceled out to homesteaders in the Oklahoma Run. And I knew I had never found anything in, you know, in his songs or his interviews, and I think everything recorded or everything he ever wrote, I have read or listened to, and never had I heard him refer to Indians except that one song that he and his brother wrote way down yonder in the Indian Nation. It was a pop song, you know, not one of his political songs. But I didn't think that was a slur because a lot of people, you know, call Indian Territory the Indian Nation. It didn't sound, you know, it didn't, you know, alert me to that. But, you know, he was a person of his time. But the thing is, he learned. And when he moved to L.A. and he had a radio show, he was doing a lot of verbal blackface, you know, racist against African Americans. And a communist African American wrote him a letter, which he read on air, castigating him for this. And he took it to heart. You know, I mean, it absolutely changed him, you know. And of course, he became very close to Huddy Ledbetter, and he became really an anti-racist. But the thing is, in those days, in that period of time, there was so little contact between settlers and Native people in any terms, you know, in any kind of equal terms where something could be explained to them why this wasn't cool. And so he was just never, and you would think Pete Seeger, you know, all these sophisticated people, they too apparently never noticed Woody's attitude toward Native people. So I think it gets to the heart of the erasure, you know, eliminationism of settler colonialism, and the caricatures and the, you know, and the you know, like the Redskins and the Chiefs and naming teams, almost, you know, cartoonish characterizations of a people that no longer exist. That's the attitude. But, you know, one can't let him off the hook for that, but still it, you know, it indicts more than just him, but everyone around him as well.
Well, you know, just to follow up on that thought, I said that, you know, I just happened to sort of fall into this really amazing struggle, which was going on in the early 1980s here, out of the arrest of some Native American fishing people for supposedly fishing out of season on their ancestral river. And I don't know, my impression was that even there, you know, the progressive community of Portland, I don't think really got it, that issue. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think the hiddenness, you know, continued and really still continues to this day. And I guess that's what your book is trying to address.
Yes, that is the main reason I wrote it. Also for, you know, especially students of history, graduate students and all. I doubt that I'll convince very many tenured faculty in history to rewrite their history books. Maybe, you know, a couple of people, but they segregate. You know, they'll pay lip service now, but they basically segregate Native American history from all other histories. So you can see whole biographies of Andrew Jackson that does not even mention, you know, Native Americans, which was, you know, the only thing that made his career was killing Indians. That was and removing Indians. That was that's the definition of Andrew Jackson. And Theodore Roosevelt, you know, who took all the sacred lands of the Native people, appropriated them for national parks. We have this, you know, this whole series on the national parks that on PBS that never once, you know, really mentions that these were and still are sacred areas of Native people. So, you know, just leaving out. And of course, in dealing with slavery, I think the biggest error in dealing with plantation slavery is not, and the development of capitalism in the United States is not simply acknowledging what they all know, and that is that land sales were, you know, the capital accumulation was through land sales, and then with the plantation system fully developed from those land sales, the production of plantation economy on Native land that was where the Indians were removed. So it, just a half of the story is being told, you know, even in all the excellent work that's been done on slavery since the civil rights movement. It was horrible before that, you know, it was put in a good light. but that has changed, but it's not a complete story. So we still have this, you know, segregation and elimination of Native people now to a kind of ghetto Native American studies. So I'm hoping this book, my intent was, you know, make it a history of the United States. And people are a little surprised when they start reading it because they say, well, they're expecting a history of Native Americans. I said, I can refer you to some really good histories of Native Americans, you know, different Native nations and overall texts and books that are really good. This is a history of the United States. And it's kind of discomforting, you know, to, oh, okay, because they want to learn more about Native Americans, they say.
What's but, from an indigenous perspective, which is the big shift that you're trying
exactly,
to make.
Yeah, exactly. It does tell the history of Native Americans, that is, you know, colonialism, being the objects of colonialism. So, I think it's going to be really hard with progressive people on the right, especially descendants of the old settlers. They're very conscious of having, you know, and in the military especially, kind of triumphalism that explains the U.S. triumphalism of having defeated all these native nations, you know, that, and they even, you know, give them credit valiantly, you know, that's why they want to honor them with all these, by naming their football teams and their military weaponry after them. They say they study counterinsurgency in the U.S. is based on studies. I didn't know this until I was at UCLA in graduate school in the 60s, and RAND Corporation is located in Santa Monica. And they used to come over, you know, creeping around among us graduate students, trying to learn something from us, maybe recruit us. You know, this was during the Vietnam War, and they were doing all these studies on counterinsurgency for the Army. And they were particularly interested, you know, Indian Wars and studying Geronimo's tactics and Tecumseh's and Crazy Horse and, you know, and the MODOK in Northern California. And they were tracing this, you know, how, what did the Army do, what did it do wrong in its, you know, counterinsurgency. So this is the other theme of the book, that, I mean, it is the most fundamental theme, that the United States was founded not only as a settler state, but as a militaristic, you know, made up of armed militias, settlers, armed militias, populist colonialism.
Well, before we get into that, let me just give out the phone number. We're 20 minutes into our show. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, and my name is Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, the author of a fairly recently published book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, out on Beacon Press. And our number here is 503-231-8187. And, you know, I that's something I also wanted to talk about, and I just wanted to give you my... I was really, really struck, I got to say, that you dealt fairly extensively with what was called the French and Indian War and then Lord Dunmore War, that whole period of time. But obviously, that shouldn't be a surprise since that was such a fundamental part of the, you know, the foundations on which this country was based. But I know about that time because my mother, Joanne Alkire Rowland, married my Italian father who immigrated from Italy, but she grew up in northern Kansas, and her people of the German part of her family had kind of hopscotched across the so-called frontier. And you talk about this as well, you know, getting and losing land and moving on. But they started out in Western Virginia before, you know, the American Revolution. And my ancestor, Harmonis Alkire, was actually in, you know, one of those original Virginian militias, and he actually fought in that war, that Lord Dunmore War, which is pretty amazing because, I mean, that was kind of, you know, real, real deep history. And so maybe you could just start out by talking a little bit about that.
Yeah, the French and Indian War, which is this 7-year war on the continent, you know, was almost many wars between Britain and France vying for both continental influence, but also in the colonies over territory in North America and the Caribbean. The French, of course, then had a, you know, after that, had a revolution, so things kind of changed. But right there at that time was the height of the competition for empire in North America, and the French were were defeated by Britain in the 7-Year War, and the called the French and Indian War, was most of the fighting took place in North America. And most of it took place, I mean, a good many Native people were fighting, you know, on the French side, because French were, well, you know, they had some settler colonialism, but generally at that time they were traders, and Native people had always traded among themselves, so new traders coming along did not bother them, you know. They didn't, you know, sometimes they were mostly men who came, and sometimes they intermarried, so you have, you know, the Métis, a very mixed people who identifies, they were generally absorbed into the Native culture and didn't impose their culture. So, and even if they, when they were hated, they were not hated as much as the British and the settlers. You know, the British really.
Oh, you're fading out a bit, Roxanne. I don't know. Maybe you could move a little bit or something. That seems to help sometimes.
Oh, am I cutting?
Yeah, your signal is not very strong.
Yeah, my cell phone, my landline wouldn't work, unfortunately. Let's see.
Well, I guess Roxanne is maybe moving location so we can maybe get a better signal here. I'm speaking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, I mentioned, the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Something of a, I don't know, I hate to use overblown language, but really a revolutionary kind of reframing of United States history from an indigenous perspective. And are you back with us, Roxanne?
I am, but I'm having a hard time getting a full signal in my own home. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay.
So,
yeah, so the French and Indian War is, you know, is the dress rehearsal for independence, because at the end of it, even though France lost, it was kind of a draw. So the Treaty of Paris that was signed had an agreement between the French and Spanish that no settlers, French or English. No settlers would be allowed over the Allegheny Appalachian mountain chain into the west, you know, into the old northwest, the Ohio Valley, that would remain Indian country, and trade could take place with both British and French, but any settlers who there illegally, which were almost all Anglo settlers, had to be returned by the British. So the British issued a proclamation of that all their citizens, their settlers, had to return to east of those mountains. Well, by that time, and probably your own ancestor, they were on their own fighting the Indians, trying to, you know, stealing from them, burning their crops, killing people, and, you know, trying to drive them out, drive the Native people out. And, of course, the Native people were farmers, too, you know, and had developed land. So it was basically stealing what they already had, you know, not taking something from scratch. That is, to me, you know, there are two reasons for the U.S. Independence from Britain, why they decided to fight and why it was popular with the settlers. One was the intention to stay and expand west, you know, out of the 13 colonies. And the other was, you know, the British end of the slave trade. End of slavery. So those were, I think, the two reasons that are rarely ever mentioned. the Declaration of Independence itself, it doesn't even mention slavery, but it does mention the merciless Indians that the British are allowing to be on the frontiers of the colonies as one reason for, but it's one reason, but it was a major reason, and I think that's why we don't even understand why the United States immediately became an imperialist power. You see them a few years later in 1801 in the Mediterranean, their merchant ships, warships, attacking the Berbers in North Africa. The Marines were invented for that under Jefferson, and that's their hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, and it was written right after the invasion of Mexico in 1846. And it was the Marines who invaded Mexico through Veracruz. It harked back to their founding in the Barbary Wars in 1801.
And you mentioned in your chapter Bloody Footprints, which I think is one of the most. I just learned so much. I actually haven't finished all the book. I've read big chunks of it throughout, but you talk about John Grenier, the first way of war, American war making on the frontier, as basically, you know, I thought it'd be interesting to talk more about this. You know, after, you know, yesterday being Veterans Day, and you know, KBOO had a lot of programming. NPR had some decent programming here on, you know, talking with veterans. And but, you know, nobody talks about this deep. I like the phrase deep history. I don't know why. But, you know, the fact that the way we make war was basically established at that time. And basically has not, you know, there's this continuity, you know, you talk about it, it's not just it's imperialism, it's just the sort of aggressiveness, the sort of what I consider a cultural psychology, which is what I think is so hard for most of us settlers to really come to grips with, that, you know, that we, whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not, we have this, you know, cultural psychology embedded in us. And obviously, you know, many of us, you know, are relatively free from the, you know, from the bloody war making aggressive aspect, but it, you know, it informs our foreign policy completely. So you were probably already going in this direction, but talk about this book, The First Way of War by John Grenier. I think that's really fundamental.
It's really an amazing book. I felt very blessed because it came out just when I had started this book and had written the first draft and was not happy with you know, I knew that wasn't how I wanted to go. And reading that book, I realized, well, what is, you know, what is the main indigenous people's interpretation of the history of the United States? It's war made against them, constant, unending, unrelenting war from, you know, the first colonies, Jamestown and Massachusetts Bay, to 1890, you know, the 1890s, without missing a beat when the United States became independent, without missing a beat, it continued. It's even during the Civil War, there were wars. That's when the people of the Navajo Nation were rounded up and put in a concentration camp. That's when the Sand Creek Massacre happened in Colorado. That's when the Dakota Uprising took place in Minnesota, and the largest mass execution in U.S. history that Lincoln ordered of the Dakota that they rounded up to kill. There's even one instance documented where in New Mexico, Confederate units and Union Army units fought on the same side against the Apaches. So this is, you know, it never missed a beat at any time from the first settlement until the last bloody massacre at Wounded Knee, that at the end of Native resistance. And that wasn't even armed resistance at the end. It was a ghost dance. It was passive resistance. It was, you know, they were not armed. They were stuck on reservations already, the Lakota, but they were doing this ghost dance, which was keeping them alive while they were almost starving. And so that massacre was related to that, make them stop dancing.
So
it's, you know, the militarism is, and then it continues in the rest of the world. They go straight to the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and then onward to the whole world.
And now it's this total war, the war on terror that we're in now. And yeah, and I would like to. Oh, we do have a caller, but before we get to that caller, I just want to throw this out. And you have a really powerful discussion of the term Indian country, and people may know that from the Vietnam War. It kind of finally came out that the United States military refers to these theaters of war as, you know, outside the United States as Indian country. And, you know, maybe we like to think that actually, oh, maybe things have actually changed, but you have some very, very recent examples of referring to these theaters of wars as Indian country. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about that right before we get to our first caller.
Yeah, and they shorten it to in country. And even, you know, with this militarization since 9/11, really since the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, the news reporters and just people in general, teachers, everyone uses that term in country, thinking they're being using a technical term for enemy territory. And that's just a shortening of Indian country. So I'm sure, you know, they don't know that, but it's a knee-jerk reaction. And it's used more because they were made aware of Indian country, but it had always been used interchangeably. And it's, you know, it's in the annal, you know, what people are taught at West Point and at the Air Force Academy, where Grenier teaches, and the Naval Academy, all of what they were taught just in basic training in the military, is it Valiant History of U.S. militarism. And, you know, a full half of that history is wars against the Indians. This is, you know, the people who fought, who were generals in the First World War, even some, you know, and their children, like MacArthur in the Second World War, go back to, you know, their ancestors being in the Army of the West and then earlier armies. And these are also always in conjunction with counterinsurgent units. Kennedy revived, you know, officially revived the Ranger, they're called Rangers, the militias are called Rangers in colonial days, and they were just citizens, armed citizens, and that's tied to the Second Amendment. Nobody seems to understand, least of all liberals. I think the descendants of the settlers well understand that this thing about being armed, having the right to arms, the Second Amendment, does mean militias. They keep saying, well, you know, that's outdated. There aren't militias anymore. Well, they consider themselves still to be armed militias. They consider their police forces to be militias. And that is to keep, you know, to keep, mostly keep African-Americans down now, but anyone who opposes the system. You know, it's a popular democratic, it's settler democracy. So that is why they hang on to it. It is their most sacred part of the, you know, of the definitely of the Bill of Rights is the Second Amendment. That's the heart of what the United States is.
Okay, well,
so no amount of gun control is going to get rid of that impulse unless it's exposed and dealt with.
Well, let's go to our first caller, I guess. Our engineer is on the phone with another caller. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and my name's Paul, and I'm speaking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, and a really groundbreaking work. I guess, I don't know, all the metaphors that we use are so steeped. You know, my mom ended up in Kansas, you know, the sod busters.
Right.
Anyway, we're just saying, well, you grew up in Oklahoma, you know this history.
Right.
But let's go to a caller. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hey, it is I, Lisa Loving, calling. And this is a great show. I really appreciate your bringing this on the air. And I also appreciate, Paul, I appreciate you sharing your family history. And I've been spending a lot of time digging into my own genealogy. You know, my friends are like, no, don't let her start talking about that. But the thing that really, I'm so glad you started talking about why this matters now. Because when people start talking about the Indian Wars of 1812 or something like that, it's all so far back there. We don't have to deal with it. And yet, it's just my personal opinion that the way we see law enforcement taking place in our streets totally harkens back to what you were just talking about. And I feel as if these issues are... They inform who we are now, but we don't even know our history.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're talking about, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz's new book, it is American history. You know what I'm saying? And it frustrates me a lot. And I have found a lot of mixed race ancestry in my genealogy that I've been tracking. But what really strikes me more than anything, and Roxanne, you keep talking about the descendants of the settlers. The thing that really freaks me out when I learn more and more about some of my ancestors, like this woman, Sina Lowry, is that, you know, that dominant paradigm, that dominant ideology, the militias, they were killing their own. You know what I'm saying? You were talking a little bit about the Mestizo people, like the mixed race people, and how all of the militias and the I don't want to use the wrong word, because sometimes people here might be offended by that, but it's like all these people... All the history that we learned about who came over on the Mayflower is just wrong. And when you start digging into your own ancestry, you learn American history in a different way. You learn how it actually affected you and yours. And so I wanted to say this other thing. I discovered this lady named, oh my God, now I'm doing it, right? There was a woman named Nancy Ward. And in my opinion, I mean, I just found out about her and read about her for the first time in this past week, right? But in my mind, I feel like she was sort of like the Cherokee Malcolm X. She lived in like the 70 years right before the Trail of Tears. And I just encourage people to look her up. Nancy Ward. Amazing people, and so many of these experiences, we just relive them over and over. And so I just wanted to thank you for doing the show. And people, you know, find out who you are and don't divorce that from the privilege that we have as white people today, because so many of us have all of these roots of these wars and these fights and these communities inside us, but then we pretend like we're not affected by it and we pretend like we're above it, but there it all plays out again and again. And thanks a lot. I just want to say that.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. That was...
That's such a good point to, you know, our recommendation that people look into their own histories. I actually decided to look into my father's family and did a book called Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie. Since my father's family, the Dunbars, and Jennings, were Scots-Irish, frontier settlers. They were the kind, you know, like your family, Paul, who kept losing land and moving on until they were the total losers ended up running for Oklahoma land, you know, the last frontier. So I always say the losers ended up in Oklahoma. And that's why it's a fairly nice place, because people are pretty humble because they're a bunch of losers. But they, and you know, they have some, you know, a little more humility about recognizing their past. But it doesn't hurt, you know, the truth really will not kill you. It is liberating. This is what I find when I deal with young people in Oklahoma. I'm back there a lot, and, you know, I organize there a lot. Young white people in Oklahoma, they feel liberated when they learn this, because you know something is kind of a burden on you, you know. Lies are a real, real burden, or, you know, living a false reality, as we do in this country. And I think when you're older, you're kind of, you know, wedded to your identity, and it's a little harder. It's not impossible. But for young people, I think getting rid of that burden of being a passive settler, you know, having this settler mentality instead of dealing with it and supporting, you know, native issues and fighting against racism, doing positive things. You're, you know, burdened. And I think that's why there's so much violence in this country, why there's so much dysfunction, drug use, alcoholism. We have the highest rates of everything like that. And imprisonment, why people have to be locked up if they are the least bit rebellious, you know, and then you're defined as rebellious if you're black or Indian or Mexican. And so more of those people get locked up, just preemptive, you know, of when they're young and for some small deeds, so that they won't be in the population. And we can't, you know, we can't deal with this stuff just by reforming these systems that are set up. We really have to start dismantling the system.
Well, we have
in our own minds.
We have, and I think, as I also perhaps somewhat ambitiously said in my blurb for this program, that what did I say? I said those who have not yet or made or attempted this perceptual and conceptual shift, meaning the shift to really look at this from the indigenous point of view, or, you know, really look at the real history, this book is a valuable aid and guide. And I really believe that. And, you know, you've built on many, many others who are, you know, you've had your own aids and guides, and we all have various ones. But, you know, in reading this, I've just, there's a richness of detail and the continuity of the narrative that is really, it builds in a really powerful way. So I don't know, I just had to say that. And I think I just really recommend people get a copy of this book. And, you know, I interview quite a few authors, and I think, you know, some of the people who wrote on here saying this, you know, this is the, you know, this may well be the most important U.S. history book you will read in your lifetime. Robin Kelly, author of Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. I mean, I know you're on the phone with us. You might be embarrassed here, but I don't know. Obviously, you wrote this book, and it was a long time in the making, so you feel strongly about it. And I just want to sort of reaffirm that. But we do have two more callers, so let's go to our next call. BJ, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. And good morning to Miss Lisa over there, Loving. Coincidence. I was thinking.
Go ahead. Make your point.
I really think that, Paul, yeah, that the, well, one of the reasons I'm stumbling here is I lost my heat. And I don't have any heat here, and the temperature's down to 40. If you know anyone that could send heat over here, I'm going to call 211. But I think the subject is very important, is education about history of this country. And there's so much coming in so fast that we need, I don't know if there's even time. I just counted four contrail C-124s fly over at about 60,000 really letting out. The reason, you know, is contrails, after it, it's about 25 miles after the aircraft.
Okay, BJ, can we stick to the point of this book we're talking about here today, please?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I agree with it. I have read these when I was younger, but I'm now a senior, so I don't know quite how to deal with the changes. They're happening so fast. At the beginning, it was okay to connect with the history of about our American heritage, and our heritage is, well, it's very changed. There were 1 million Native Americans here before we came. There were 1 million before Columbus came. I didn't come. Columbus came, I guess. It's just not true that they were the first, you know. It's just not true. I don't know what to say more about
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling.
I read a lot about that. But, Paul, would you guys call me back, see if I survive this?
Okay.
This loss of power here. It's just circuit breakers downstairs. But because I'm in a wheelchair, don't call the police. They'll break my door down to get in because I can't get to the doors and I can't go down.
Well, call somebody. Somebody. I don't think we can specifically help you, but I'm sure if you call, you know, somebody might, you know, maybe a neighbor or somebody you know. But I hope you deal with that situation, BJ. Thank you for calling. Okay, and we have Joanne on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I can hardly hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. We're waiting.
Okay. great program. I wish we had programs like this on cable way before now and continuing. But anyway, this phrase that Paul or Roxanne use, that we're a culture of war psychology or something. Well, anyway, my question about that is, does religions reinforce or support this phrase you're talking about, a culture of war psychology or whatever it's called? And I'll get off the air and listen to you.
Okay. Good question.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's, I have a whole chapter on the Christian religious setting for the development of colonialism. Christianity, only the Catholic Church, well, the Orthodox, existed prior to colonization when Protestantism began. But the canon law of the 15th century, first of all, in 1454, gave Portugal the permission, the Pope gave Portugal permission to invade West Africa to take Africans as slaves. So that sort of marks the beginning of overseas colonialism. And then in 1492, the Spanish monarchy sent Columbus on a voyage. And 2 years later, the Pope issued another papal bull that divided the world between the Spanish and the Portuguese. And this is called the Doctrine of Discovery. Then the Protestant, this then included France too, but even England, adopted the Doctrine of Discovery as a fundamental international law. This is marked as the founding of Western international law. As colonialism is also the onset of capitalism, because the way they accumulated, the gold bullion and what was already developing as capitalism, it was in the looting of the Western Hemisphere. So this doctrine of discovery still exists. It's alive and sick in the United States law. It is still the governing law that structures the relationship between the U.S. government and Native American nations in the United States. It was in the 1820s, the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Marshall made a series of decisions that identified the Doctrine of Discovery as international law and the guiding law that controlled the relationship between the U.S. government and Native people, and identified Native nations as domestic dependent nations that had no inherent rights that they might be given by the United States graciously, you know, something. But they had no inherent rights once they were discovered and appropriated. No other country in the world, not even the papacy itself, any longer uses the doctrine of discovery, but the United States sticks with it. So this is, again, I like to emphasize that this book is not just history. It's the living present in the military, in the law, that structures the colonial relationship. So religion was, you know, was the foundation. The Christian religion was, from its inception as an institutionalized church, they began the Crusades to supposedly retake the Holy Land from which the religion came. And we're still trying to retake it, the Christians are. So, and then there was this bump in the road that Islam formed 6 centuries after Christianity. And the Crusades then were set off. So the colonialism, overseas colonialism, really was designed first through the Crusades and their behavior, counterinsurgency, attacking civilian populations, burning their crops, starving them, creating refugees as the way of war that then is exported to the colonies intact, with the institutions intact. And then the British, you know, the English first conquered Wales, Scotland, and then Ireland, and set up in that period of time, the 4 centuries of that conquest, set up the institutions that would be used for setting up their colonies in North America. So it wasn't just, you know, happenstance. It was a very, it's a very systematic colonial institutions. And then by the time they get to colonizing all of Africa, Asia, the Pacific, the Caribbean, these institutions are just, you know, automatically imposed, and always very brutal. So now we, you know, we're in a period of supposed decolonization that started after World War II with the rising up even much earlier, you know, in India and Africa, the Pacific and the Caribbean for independence. But there are many people still living under colonization in the Caribbean and the Pacific, in North America, in parts of Latin America.
And the indigenous peoples in North America as well.
Yeah, right. Yeah, indigenous peoples in North America and both Canada and the United States are living under colonial conditions.
Well, we're winding down. I don't know. Let's try to sneak one more caller in. You've been waiting patiently. John, go ahead.
Yeah, after my parents died, my siblings and myself, we went to visit a couple of people who were still living. And, you know, these people were in their 80s. And, of course, when you get older, you have no more skeletons in the closet. So we were just sitting there gnawing the fat. And I found on both sides of my family, the female sides, grandmother and great-grandmothers, were half and quarter Native Americans. So, of course, the thing came out and said, well, how come our parents didn't say anything? They said it was kind of shameful to have anything back in your, you know, history other than being, you know, Anglo-Saxon. And I saw this one documentary by Ken Burns, The Oregon Trail, and they were talking about most of the male settlers here in the Oregon country married Native American women. The same thing down in South Africa when the Dutch were down there. They had Zulu brides. So anybody, it was explained to me, anybody who's been more than 4 generations in this country have something else other than Northern European.
John, I'm going to have to cut you off because we have only 1 minute. I appreciate that call, and that would be the occasion for an extended reflection as well as as everything that has been mentioned could go in so many different directions. This is a extremely richly detailed book. We could have talked a lot about your own life and activism, but these are the limitations of this medium. So Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, I really appreciate it. We're in the works trying to organize an event with you coming to Portland, perhaps next February. So
I'm very excited about that.
Okay. Well, let's keep working on that, and hopefully we'll see you then, and hopefully we'll be talking to you before that. Thank you very much, Roxanne. Okay.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, bye-bye. This is KBOO Portland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO.
This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert.
A sweet harmony will set us free and leave our...
Artichoke Music, Satori Men's Chorus, and Mark Bosnian will present Songs of Community, a benefit for KBOO Community Radio, Thursday, November 13th, 7:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. This concert celebrates Portland's love for local music and local community radio. Tickets are available in advance from Brown Paper Tickets or at the door. All proceeds benefit KBOO. To learn more, go to the KBOO website and click under Community Events on the right side of the homepage. That's KBOO.FM. Songs of Community, a benefit for KBOO Community Radio.
And this is KBOO, KBOO Portland. Good morning. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's Political Perspectives. Host Jay Thiemeyer today speaks with Mike Carnosh of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, Jim Robison, chair of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, and Barbara Quinn of Willamette Speaks about the state of the Willamette River and what it will take to restore the river. At 9:30, Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock interviews